Let me introduce our first speaker, Terry Kruse. And Terry serves as a senior advisor to a number of national nonprofits and institutions, including the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. And she has also worked with the Georgetown Climate Center, Applied Solutions, the Western Governors Association. She's authored or co-authored a couple of studies under the Pew Center, one adapting to climate change, a call for federal leadership. She authored Adaptation Planning, What U.S. States Are Doing. So both of those hopefully will be resources that she's drawing on as she gives you an overview of what state and local governments, what types of frameworks they've been using to do adaptation planning, and give you a little bit more information about how they're mainstreaming that into their other services. So I'll turn it over to you, Terry.
Thank you, Catherine. So we often hear the term uncertainty being used in the context of both climate change mitigation and adaptation. And this pertains to uncertainty about the effects of greenhouse gas emissions, the timeframes for policies to make a difference, you know, at what thresholds will we hit a point of no return or irreparable harm, you know, what is sea level rise expected to be in this location or that location, or precipitation levels and so on. And I just want to tee this off by saying that adaptation planning and the methodologies or frameworks that we already have available to us today enable the planning and implementations of projects to ensue by accepting uncertainty into the process. And the key here in this quote is taking into consideration the range of possible climate futures. And I would go further in expressing the need to consider the range of possible futures in general in your area of responsibility, including the climate futures. So according to the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, 33 states have completed recent climate action plans to address greenhouse gas mitigation, while 13 states have started or completed their first state adaptation plan or framework. And I just want to call out Maryland here, that's in dark blue, because they're indicated as complete. They finished their first phase adaptation planning effort in 2008, and that focused on coastal areas and sectors impacted by sea level rise and coastal storms. However, they're now in the process with a phase two planning effort focusing more on inland sectors such as agriculture, forestry, public health, land use, water, resource management. And they just present a great example of what adaptation planning is all about in the sense of it being an iterative, ongoing effort that it's not a one-time plan and you're done. These are a list of local governments that have initiated adaptation planning efforts. There tend to be, you know, two main pathways for initiating local adaptation planning, and I'm sure Michaela will talk about this later. But in general, it typically seems to initiate where there are efforts already underway, like mitigation planning or sustainability efforts, or it can even stem from a single person or an agency faced with addressing an impact, such as flooding or heat waves, and through the research and through those efforts, making a case to create the justification for a broader initiative. And I just want to make a note here that there are a number of sector and impact-specific adaptation plans and efforts and projects on the ground that are occurring at both state and local levels, independent of these comprehensive adaptation plans that you're seeing here from both the state and the localities. In 2007, the Heinz Center released this a report that compared 8 adaptation planning guidebooks and frameworks that they felt were applicable to Western countries. Two that I'll highlight on here, one is the Climate Impact Group out of the University of Washington in partnership with King County, Washington, and ICLEI. They created a guidebook that I think is rather seminal that has been utilized by many state and local governments since it came out. And the other one I would highlight here is UK SIP, and we'll come back to that one. But those are both two that I would point people to. And even, you know, this survey was done 3 years ago, and since that time, most of these have been updated, and you can see the variation in these check marks, where there were gaps, where there were strengths and weaknesses across the different frameworks against these comparison criteria, and use that as a guide for maybe what you're trying to do and where you're looking for some support. But again, many of these have been updated. A lot of the areas have been filled in where there were gaps. Specifically, I can speak to that in terms of the UK SIP one. And I can tell you that the SIG one that I just mentioned, the ICLEI guidebook, is currently being evaluated for an update again as well, based on local government feedback. But even since then, this is a list of just four, these top four planning frameworks have all just come out in 2010, and one's coming out in 2011. The first one here is the Center for Climate Strategies. They've helped over 20 states with climate action plans, primarily focused on mitigation. However, they did work with a few states that chose to put their adaptation planning efforts in with their mitigation planning efforts, like Alaska and Florida. And they're publishing a guidebook specifically targeting U.S. states that is due to come out in early 2011 that you may want to know about. And then ICLEI, mentioned here again, they have a suite of tools to support adaptation planning by local governments. And they just announced their new Climate Resilient Communities Program and a new online adaptation database and planning tool called ADAPT. And they've put their five-step planning methodology into an online tool for users. There's also sector and impact-specific guides that are coming out, and specifically the one I've listed here, NOAA, their Office of Ocean and Coastal Resource Management, just released this planning guide for state coastal managers. And as well, you can see the Drought Ready Communities organization released a guide for community drought preparedness. So what we're seeing is that adaptation is becoming better understood, and this is particularly true from a governance level. And there's an increasing demand from, you know, people like everyone on this call, from members, from constituents, for more information and more tools and more direct support, you know, getting into specifics in terms of impacts or sectors where you have interest. And there's obviously a response occurring, and that's great. What I've listed on here also are some decision-making frameworks. And so in parallel to this trend, what I'm seeing is more demand on the next in, you know, further down the spectrum in terms of not just helping me get my plan going, but helping me to make a decision as it pertains to my adaptation options. And we're seeing decision-making frameworks emerge. The one I'll mention here, Georgetown Climate Center's Adaptation Toolkit, that is coming out in 2011, is directed specifically at land use managers to help them prepare for sea level rise. And this toolkit provides an analysis of available land use policy responses that they're calling tools, but also helping users select amongst those potential responses for their given circumstances. And so these are just some examples of what we're starting to see, and I expect to see more of this. So because I'm not going through all of those frameworks in detail, I just wanted to call out kind of the general steps that you can expect to see in these frameworks listed here. And we're going to talk about a couple of these in more detail. But the key factor is that the frameworks are all iterative in nature. And you'll see, I'll show you one example. But they iterate back through themselves. They go through these steps, and then at the end it calls to update the plan again. You know, you're continually monitoring and hopefully reporting on your results, and then using new information, whether it's climate data, you know, actual results, trends, and you're revisiting your plan. And it's a continual process, using the best information that you have available at the time and moving forward where it makes sense to move forward based on your specific vulnerabilities, your specific risks, your specific goals, your decision-making criteria that you define, and other factors such as funding and resource availability and things specific to your community or your area of responsibility. And it's also important to note that I would say that none of these frameworks are a one-size-fits-all, and it's completely dependent on the scope that you choose to bite off and where you are and what you're hoping to achieve. So I would encourage you to be familiar with more than one framework and reach out and get information from your peer groups as well. But I'll talk through a couple of these items right here now. So in terms of authorizing mechanisms that have been used at the state level for state adaptation planning processes, you can see here that 8 of the states used an executive order and 5 of the states used legislation. Both of these mechanisms are very important to providing credibility and financial and technical support to the planning process. And more importantly, I would say the longevity that's required to sustain these efforts, which is so critical to adaptation, given the long time frames for which planning and implementation and monitoring is needed, not just year, not just 2 years, 5 years, but 10, 20, 30, 50 years time frames that we're dealing with here. Priority focus areas. So a key step in the process is determining your scope of effort. And what we typically see at the state level is an adaptation subcommittee or a task force being created as part of an overall comprehensive climate initiative, in parallel with mitigation planning efforts. This is ideal given the amount of effort and synergies that do exist between mitigation and adaptation planning. The ramp-up cost and the time is certainly a factor, but more importantly, you have the cross-pollination opportunity that you can have not just between your adaptation teams, but between your adaptation teams and your mitigation teams. And I would say that more of this is needed in adaptation planning that we've seen in the United States, the need to do a better job of integrating our adaptation and planning, mitigation planning efforts. And if you think about it, there are some sectors of common interest, such as transportation and land use, built infrastructure, energy, agriculture, forestry, and so on, and where you can identify those synergies, there can be co-benefits that arise. And think of it also just that you don't want to implement a strategy under one umbrella, let's say it's the mitigation side, that adversely affects something you're trying to do on the adaptation side and vice versa. So the second point here in terms of getting selecting your priority focus areas is that we see that the states have typically formed technical working groups that focus on vital sectors that have been identified to be impacted by climate change that are important to that state or that community based on economic or cultural or human safety and health issues. It can be, anything that affects our human systems, our built systems, our natural systems. And I just want to highlight one example because I think it's a phenomenal one. Wisconsin, their WICI program, they've started their planning efforts, their adaptation planning efforts, and they've taken a very unique approach in forming their working groups, and they've created sector-based working groups such as agriculture and public health and wildlife. But they also created some technical working groups focused specifically one on Green Bay, so they're large communities, and one on Milwaukee, and they actually created impact-specific teams, one for soil and one for stormwater management in urban areas. And I think this is just very interesting because soil is the foundation of Wisconsin's agriculture industry, and they're seeing, precipitation patterns changing and threatening, that economic industry for them that they need to put, use that as a rationale for a working group dedicated just to soil. Lastly, the last point on here about dual adaptation planning initiatives, what I mean by this is I'll give you an example using Alaska. Alaska created an Alaska Climate Change Advisory Group to develop their long-term adaptation plan as part of a broader statewide climate change strategy, but they also initiated an immediate action work group responsible for making recommendations, implementing adaptive actions, and delivering progress reports on an annual basis. And this was due to the immediate threat that existed to coastal villages from sea level rise and storm surges. And so my point in all of this is that this is a very unique process to you and your needs, and there is no one right way of doing this. You have to assess your own situation and don't feel like you have to copy somebody else. You can certainly learn from these different examples, but I would say that I would customize it specifically to your needs and your priorities. This is just a visual to give you an idea of some of the sectors that have been covered in the state plan so far, and just to give you a sense of kind of where the priority has been. It's quite impressive, and I will say that not all sectors are represented here. This is a broad brush, but I tried to pick the ones that had the heaviest coverage. And also, you can see that, like, infrastructure, well, that could include energy infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, water infrastructure, so sometimes the labels can be you know, have some overlapping meaning in case you don't see something up here you expected to see. Sometimes the technical working groups will take on one sector, like in, with Kurt will speak to this for California, but, you know, there's sometimes, depending on your financial situation or your expertise within your agencies or your priority focus areas, you may find that technical working groups take on more than one sector, or you may find they're just dedicated to a single sector or impact or community or population. And that's just completely, you know, your decision. One thing I will talk about briefly here are vulnerability and risk assessments, and each of the frameworks that I evaluated definitely call for some level of these assessments to be conducted. Vulnerability assessments help you inform your priority areas for planning. They also can help you identify viable adaptation options, and viable meaning politically viable, financially viable, technically viable. But a vulnerability assessment basically includes identifying what resources or systems, and defined how you want to define these. These are sectors, these are human or built systems, these are communities, these could be populations. But identifying the systems that are exposed to climate, whether or not they are affected by that climate change, and whether or not they're able to cope with the changes on their own. And that's, so the technical terminology that you may hear, you know, the exposure, the sensitivity, and the adaptive capacity, and it's those components that determine the vulnerability of a resource or a system. And risk assessments are then used to help prioritize these vulnerabilities and can also be used to help prioritize adaptation options for a range of potential scenarios that could occur. And the current frameworks that I've seen, and I apologize, I don't have an example of this here, but they typically use a matrix approach and consider the likelihood or the probability of an impact occurring and the consequence of the impact should it occur, you know, using kind of like a high, medium, low type approach and helping you rank your vulnerabilities and your decision-making process. So it can be used, the risk assessment models can be used in a number of ways. But the frameworks and the consulting organizations out there do vary on their approaches to these assessments, and I would, again, say that it behooves you to become familiar with the trade-offs associated with the different approaches. And I just want to mention that there's a lot of intricacies within this area, and it's a much longer discussion, but there are trade-offs between specific actions to reduce vulnerabilities and going after what would be, oftentimes there's a term called low regret adaptation options where, you know, you're doing those things and you're getting started with those things that you would do otherwise, and they're just good decisions to make, you know, in general and irrespective of climate, but then when you put climate in it makes even more sense. And yes, that is, there are different strategies that can be used in deciding where to invest your dollars and what adaptation options to take on. But I just will say that there are always going to be trade-offs in some of those decisions, and so that these assessments are designed to try and help you get through those different trade-offs.
Terry, I know you have to leave to catch a plane, and we wanted to at least grab a few minutes of your time to answer questions before that. So I just wanted to check your time, make sure you have enough time left.
Yep.
Thanks.
I'm wrapping up right now. This is just a sample decision-making framework from UKCIP. This is a very high-level framework. It doesn't go into the risk assessment, but this is just to give you a visual image of the iterative process that I was describing. These are some key elements of the frameworks that we see, and we've talked through a few of these already. I think one that I would highlight that I think is important is to have an oversight entity for adaptation, and this applies whether it's a state or locality with, you know, if you're using multiple technical working groups, but having an oversight group that can persist beyond the planning process, beyond the planning phase itself, and that can still persist into and beyond the implementation and monitoring phases, and provide continual, you know, oversight for the development and actualization of the plan. Lastly, I just want to bring up one point, and that's to cover the concept of mainstreaming. And mainstreaming in this context is considering adaptation in your existing planning processes that are already affected by climate. And you can apply this more broadly to be the consideration of climate change in general, picking up both mitigation and adaptation. But in this context, what I would say is that, you know, the benefit is that it will increase the awareness of climate change within your organizations, within our agencies, you know, NGOs, the private sector, and our communities. It helps to build the awareness of our current and projected impacts. It also builds on the knowledge and expertise that you already have, and adding climate in is just another factor that you are considering on top of the other things you're already considering in your planning process, the other variables. So if you're dealing with a water supply issue and you're already developing scenarios assuming population growth, then you're now considering population growth and different climate change scenarios to come up with your different viable adaptation options. So this is a simplistic example, but I just encourage people to, you know, consider this. And there's a report that was released. I'll put it in my references for folks called Anticipatory Governance, and I'll add it into my list. But the downside with mainstreaming approaches for adaptation is these do not promote cross-agency or cross-organizational collaboration by themselves. They won't necessarily identify all the risks and vulnerabilities that exist or create the best solutions in all cases, especially if an impact crosses sectors or geographic or political boundaries or jurisdictions. And for this reason, it is a great it's wonderful when it's part of a comprehensive planning process where it's one of many recommendations of actions for agencies to go do. And these are just some examples that of today of plans that we all see and know about where adaptation could be mainstreamed into these. And I've put some examples down where Keene, New Hampshire, Michaela speaking after me, but Keene is the very first community we know of to have incorporated adaptation into their community master plan. And that is all I have.
Thanks very much, Terry. Mm-hmm. That's a great overview. And we have a ton of questions coming in. And I know Terry, unfortunately, had an unexpected trip she had to make and has to leave on a flight.
Yes,
so
I
she
do.
Has agreed to stick around a few minutes to answer some questions that we've got coming in. And let me just throw a few at you quickly. One is the question about monitoring and whether or not local governments and states should be thinking about and integrating monitoring, including setting baselines, setting up tracking systems, as they're doing their adaptation planning, or that should be something that they just wait and do afterwards.
Oh, no, absolutely. It needs to be integrated into the process, and I'm sorry we had to jump over that step and I didn't have a detail on this. But absolutely. So I don't know if you earlier on in the presentation in the general steps that we see, there are steps that call for setting goals. And monitoring systems are important. There's kind of two different types of monitoring systems. Monitoring systems in the sense of what you see out in the field. Let's say you're monitoring your wildlife or you're monitoring your public health. Different, you know, air quality is, you know, would be another example. So there are those kind of technical monitoring systems that are very important if you have put in adaptive strategies that you want to monitor the results. Let's say it's, you know, wildlife results to see if you're affecting positively their ability to adapt. There's also the kind of monitoring system in terms of that people will talk about when in terms of monitoring the adaptation plan itself and monitoring the planning process itself. And having a way to come back and see if your plan was actually effective. And so it depends on the terminology that's being used here. But, yes, it's very important to integrate it from the beginning. And there's one of the planning frameworks that I evaluated that actually calls for metrics to be defined in the key sectors or priority areas that you choose to evaluate. So this is a longer discussion, but the short answer is yes.
Thank you. And another question was, in your presentation, you did mention the importance of integrating adaptation and mitigation. Could you say a little bit more about how you would integrate adaptation and existing emergency response planning or risk management efforts at the state and local level?
So this goes back to that's a great example of mainstreaming. And let me see if I can go back here. So if your focus is just that. Emergency management plans could, and I can't remember which community it was. If it was Ohio, I was on a phone call just recently, and there was one of the states was talking about how they had this large precipitation event, and they were, I think it was the Ohio floods a couple years ago. So, and they realized that they had not updated their emergency management plans to consider how to get, you know, people across from one part of the community to the other that got flooded out. And so that, when I was talking about mainstreaming. You do have the ability now, and it's one of those very low regret, you know, robust adaptation strategies that you can pull the trigger on without much investment that allows you to update your plans. And that way, if a certain scenario occurs, you actually have the plan on the shelf to invoke that strategy. And so it's not something that, you know, you invoke unless the climatic events occur. And so that should be done and can be done without necessarily having a broader statewide comprehensive adaptation effort ensue. I don't know if that answered the question.
I think you hit it. And one of the other questions was whether or not your comment that mainstreaming increases institutional awareness has any kind of empirical evidence behind it. I think the participant said that they are concerned that mainstreaming may in fact be a way of diluting attention to climate change as the main problem.
So the latter point can absolutely be true, and that is the risk, and that is one of the downsides of presenting this. So on the one hand, and that's why I say it's great when it's used as one piece of a comprehensive planning effort, and I agree with the comment that it can oversimplify what's needed, because it is important that these plans do consider climate, but they alone, if you were to just go do one of these things, imagine if you are within an agency and you have responsibility for something that has implications, let's say you're within a state agency, but it has implications with your counterparts at the local government, your counterparts at the federal government, and your counterparts within the private sector. And if you're the only one updating your plan, your piece of it, then it can create, you know, what we were terming as leaders and laggards, in the sense that, you know, you're fulfilling your public responsibility, but if those around you don't, that are integral to a more comprehensive strategy and more comprehensive solutions, then you're not getting that. So there is absolutely a risk of mainstreaming when it's not part of a more broad, comprehensive, integrated effort. And with that,
also wondering if one of your slides showing the resources might have gotten at this, but one of the questions is that as you're doing the type of risk assessment that state and local governments would need to do, you need obviously a lot of information about forecast temperature, precipitation, sea level rise. So the question is there a clearinghouse for this kind of information at either the state or regional level?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are a number of resources available to people, and specifically on the climate impact side, I would point people to the USGCRP website, that the seminal report that just, you know, the one that came out from the USGCRP that provides the sectoral and regionally based climate change impact information, the most recent for the United States that we have, and it goes down to a sector and it divides the United States up into key regions. There's more information that is needed that is even more granular than that, and that is available as well. I do work with the Georgetown Climate Center, and one of the projects that we're working on right now is an adaptation resources clearinghouse. And we'll announce it in 2011, early 2011, but one of our goals is to try and have as many resources as it pertains to planning, including the impacts by sector, for people available in that clearinghouse. But as far as existing ones, I would also refer to the NOAA Climate Center, the climate service site. NOAA is trying to pull that together. But as far as other sectors and sector-specific information, I would say that we'll try and push out an announcement when our clearinghouse is available.
Let me do a time check before I ask you any more questions. We've got some that probably take a lengthier responses and some short ones.
Sorry.
Do you have time for one more?
It depends on the question, but are you
really? Okay. I'll give you two short ones. On the slide that you're showing now, you have the term VTrans up as one of the transportation. What is VTrans?
I'm sorry, that's Vermont.
Okay.
Vermont.
That was a question.
I apologize. That's Vermont's VTrans.
And are there examples of the matrix format available online that you recommend to assess risks?
Yes. So if you go back to the slide that had the table of the planning frameworks and as well as the Heinz Center table that had like the eight, just use that and go hit those and look inside, and you'll see some of the risk assessment matrices that I'm referring to. Also, you can talk, if you're a local government, I would suggest looking at the ICLEI one, and if you're a state government, like I said, very soon the CCS one will be out, and they both have their matrices that they use. So if you're a member of ICLEI, you would have access to that immediately.
Well, thanks very much for hanging on a little bit longer. There are a lot of additional questions, and Terry, are you still up for trying to respond to at least as many as you can after the call via email? Maybe we can post those responses on the website afterwards.
Absolutely.
We also, just to let the participants know, I see that we're getting a lot of sharing of information, and we'll try to get that posted too. People are sharing information resources as well as some of their own experience in their own state and local communities.
Well, I would very much value any resources that people want to share with us, with me specifically, that we can put into the clearinghouse. That would be wonderful. So if people do know of plants that have been updated to incorporate climate change adaptation, for instance, that would be wonderful to share those. If anybody on the call wants to provide those to us, we'll make sure they make it into the clearinghouse.
All right. Thank you very much, and safe travels.
Thank you very much.